My name's Andrew Tridgell. I'm going to tell you a bit about rsync, and I'm going to be concentrating on the rsync algorithm for this talk as opposed to the rsync tool. A lot of people are familiar with the tool itself, but there's actually some interesting technology underlying the tool, which I'm trying to get a few more people to know about the technology because it has some uses outside of the tool, and I want to hopefully see it used in a far wider range of applications than what it's currently being used in. And so I'm hoping that by introducing a few more people to the ideas underlying the internals of the tool, that it might be implemented in a few more places. And I'm hoping that eventually the algorithmic part of the tool will become as ubiquitous as like Qsort or Memcopy or other standard algorithms, standard utility functions that people use all the time in their programming. So The core of rsync is this algorithm that I call the rsync algorithm, and it solves this problem, the remote update problem. Now, the remote update problem is basically you have two computers connected by a very high latency, very low bandwidth link, a typical internet link, at least if you're in Australia. So very, very piece of wet string, you know, really pathetic link, and you've got two files, or two, the algorithm actually just works in arbitrary lumps of data, so you've got two lumps of data, one sitting on one of the computers and the other sitting on the other computer, and you want to update one of the lumps of data to be the same as the other one. So you're trying to just update a file remotely, and you don't know, it's really it's like the morning after algorithm. It's an algorithm meant for when you didn't have the forethought to, at one end or the other, have a copy of the old file so you could run a diff or an xdelta or some other tool like that. So you don't have any way of doing a local diff between the two files and sending that. Now, the rsync algorithm is a way of solving this problem. And much like neural networks are sort of the last resort for people who don't understand the problem, you know, rsync is, you know, a good way of solving this problem where you don't know exactly what types of changes have been made to the data. There are always more efficient algorithms than rsync, okay? If you have structured data and you know precisely the types of updates and the constraints on the sorts of updates that can happen to the data, then you can always craft a better algorithm than rsync, and that's provable just by saying, well, you could always craft rsync. But in fact, you'll very likely be able to craft a much better algorithm. But rsync is useful because it doesn't require any thinking and doesn't require any forethought to organize to have particular information about the old files stored beforehand. Okay, so it's like this morning after algorithm for copying data when you need to, you know, update remote data. You don't know the old data, or you don't have any control over the remote changes. For example, you may not have any knowledge about what changes have been made at the other end of the link because you're not the person who made those changes, and yet you're the person who's got to update from that file. Okay, so how do you go about doing this? Now, prior to these sorts of algorithms, really there were only two ways of doing this. One was you could just throw some compression at it, right? You could just compress the file and send the compressed file. Okay, that might gain you factor of 3, factor of 5, factor of 100 if it's a spam file or something. So you might be able to get some speed up if the file is reasonably compressible. But that really isn't enough. You know, people want more of a speed up than that, just because there's a lot more data there, and there's a lot more information you're not taking advantage of. You have the old file. It's likely that the old file has a lot in common with the new file, because usually in a big file the changes are small. Okay, where I'm deliberately being vague here, small on an undefined scale. Right, as soon as you start defining the scale of the size of the changes, actually defining those, then you immediately have to get into the area of structured changes and structures to the file, in which case you probably shouldn't be using rsync anyway. So the next thing is you could keep the old file. You could have some forethought and arrange at one end or the other to always keep the old file, and that way you can always send a diff. And that's not always practical. So the remote update problem is there a better way of doing this, of updating the files remotely without all this prior knowledge and doing better than just compression, taking advantage of the data in the old file? And now, well, first of all, maybe we should actually get you guys to give some ideas. Those of you who already read the paper about rsync maybe shouldn't say what the idea is. Can anyone here suggest how you might do this? What are some... what I find is that it's a bit embarrassing, really. I took several years to work on the rsync algorithm, but generally when I describe the problem to somebody as a fresh problem, most people in the CS department back at ANU worked it out in about half an hour. But then again, they knew that there was a solution, or I wouldn't have been asking them. You know, maybe with a few people, work it out much quicker. So do you have any suggestions? How would you go about doing this?
You break the file up into half and then try and do a checksum on...
Yep.
...compare the checksums until they keep breaking it up into smaller sections until you...
Indeed you could. Problem is, what if somebody has inserted one byte at the beginning of the file? Then neither half is going to match a half at the other end. Right, that will only work if you've modified exactly half of the file, or you've kept things aligned. If the alignments have changed at all, if any of the data has slid in the file, even by one byte, then any algorithm based on matching blocks with corresponding blocks at the other, in the other file won't work. Okay? So what another idea?
You could take 16 bytes and send that, and then have the other end look for that in their file.
Right.
Checksum over, say, a K or something after the
Okay, you could indeed. Now, if you're sending just 16 bytes at a time because you've got a lot of round trips, this is another one of the constraints. I'm going to change the problem on you, and I'm going to add the additional constraint. I want to do the whole thing in one round trip. In fact, I want to do it in one round trip for any number of files. Even if you have 10,000 files, I want one round trip in total. Okay, just to make it a bit harder. Let's consider just one file at first, though. Right, but I'm not just changing... There's still another slight problem. Say you had the... You sent checksums of every 16 bytes, right, to the other end. Well, first of all, that's going to be big. It's going to be a large percentage of the file, so 16 is too small. So let's make it, say, 600 instead. Okay, then the checksum's going to be maybe a 1% or something of the file, something of that order, which is getting more reasonable. Then you've got a slight problem that you'll have to checksum it at every offset at the other end. Now, say it's a megabyte file at the other end. That means you'll be calculating a million checksums.
That's why I said just send 16 bytes, not the checksum of 16 bytes.
Right.
So then you can just look for that 16 bytes.
Ah, right. And then you're getting very close. In fact, the very first version of rsync used something very similar to this. Rsync actually came out of some work I did on search algorithms. How many of you know about the Boyer-Moore-Gosper string searching algorithm? Very, very common. Where you have basically a delta table, and you jump the length of the delta table. I was doing some work on searching large text databases, and I wanted to search for multiple alternates. We were looking up in a thesaurus where somebody was looking for something like Apple, and what you do is you look up a thesaurus for all the synonyms of Apple in different languages, or pears and oranges and related words, and you want to search for any of those in a single pass. So you can do a thing called a multi-alternate BMG algorithm, and there's very fast ways of doing that. And the very first rsync algorithm did in fact do that. It sent chunks of data. What it did is divided the file into blocks, and it sent the first few bytes and the last few bytes of each block and the checksum of the whole block. And then what it did is it used this multi-alternate BMG search algorithm to search for the beginning of the block or the end of the block in the file. And where it found that the beginning of the block matched, it checked, does the end of the block also match, and does the whole checksum of the block match, in which case it says we've probably got a block match. So in fact, you're close. Unfortunately, it ends up being rather slow. It does work, though, and rsync 0.01 did that. But it was unacceptably slow, because although multi-alternate search algorithms are much faster than standard BMG-type algorithms, they're still far too slow. We actually need a search algorithm that's linear and about the same speed as a memory copy. Okay, other ideas?
GNU diff splits the file into chunks at
yep.
character terms and checksums each line, and then searches for checksums which match nearby.
Right. First of all, text-based. Not much good. The other thing is GNUdiff relies on the bandwidth between the two files being very, very high. Right, it's local. Both files are local.
But it could be done in a distributed fashion. It could send
not using the diff algorithm, no.
Not using the diff algorithm directly. But
you can use... This is what Xdelta is, okay?
You can send the checksums.
Yes, you can send checksums. What you'll end up with is basically something a bit like the rsync algorithm, but you're exactly right. But as soon as you have differing sized blocks, then you'll find that the bandwidth requirements to get sufficient data to the other end for the search algorithm will be massive. So those local differencing algorithms can use differing sized blocks, right, when they can use like carriage returns and things. But as soon as you go remote and you're worried about the cost of sending the signatures and the cost of doing the search and things, you really have to go to even sized. Okay, other ideas? Yep?
We could find the first suggestion of progressively doing like a binary breakup of the
right.
file with looking for the blocks that we've broken up and moving them.
Right, you could look for them. Okay, so you could break it up into blocks at one end, and at the other end you could look on different boundaries and not just the block boundaries.
Right.
Okay, that's getting closer. Yes, in fact, you want to look on every boundary. You want to look on every single byte boundary at the other end. Yeah.
Be
pardon?
So we found this, but it was offset this far. Since with it where it was,
okay.
Offset this far when we get it back.
Right, you could, yes. But the problem there is you still have to... The sending it back is no problem. The data format for sending it back is that there's many, many possible formats you could use. It's more the fact that it's an n squared if you're doing your checksumming at every single offset, right, then you've got a million different offsets in a 1 megabyte file. You're going to do a million strong checksums. You're going to be there all day. It's too slow. So how do we make that faster? Yep. Aha, right. That's exactly right. Use a rolling checksum, and that's the core of rsync. Basically, rsync combines a rolling checksum with a strong checksum. The rolling checksum is not critical to the algorithm except for speed. The rolling checksum is a filter on the strong checksum to make sure that you only run the strong checksum when the rolling checksum matches. Okay, those of you who don't know what a rolling checksum is, maybe I should... Yes, I'll start explaining that. Okay, in fact, I'll explain that now, then I'll get on with the rest of the talk. A rolling checksum is a updatable checksum or updatable hash. Say you've got a buffer here, you know, in the middle of the air about there, and you know the checksum of that buffer, and you want to know the checksum of this buffer, 1 byte along, where 1 byte has been added on the end and 1 byte is removed from the beginning. So you've slid a little window along by 1 byte in a file. Now, a rolling checksum is a checksum where you can calculate the new checksum from the old checksum with a very small number of operations. Maybe 3 or 4 adds and a couple of subtracts and XOR or something. A very small number of operations to get from a checksum in this location to a checksum in that location. And that's called the rolling property of a checksum. And that is the key to making rsync efficient. Okay, so let's have a look now. To answer that question, yes, there is a better way. And the basic algorithm goes something like this. Although those of you who have been following the little... bit we've been doing so far, we'll now already know this, and you can go and look at one of the other talks. First of all, we do signature generation. And what we do is we generate what I call a signature block for the old file. Okay. In fact, you can invert this whole thing, and you can send the differences in either direction, either from the receiver to the sender or sender to the receiver. There's two different ways of doing it. I'm going to explain the one that is in the rsync tool. The one that's in the rsync library, which is part of some other applications of rsync, in fact, does a thing in the other direction for various reasons that I'll get into later. Signature generation, we generate a signature block. Now, the signature block consists of a checksum. You take a file, say a megabyte, divide it into, say, 600 or 700 byte chunks, or kilobyte chunks, say, you know, chunks of about that size, and you take 2 checksums on each block. One of them has this rolling property that you mentioned, and the other is a conventional hash. I use MD4 because I happen to have an MD4 routine lying around that it's nice and fast. So you take these 2 hashes on each block, you bundle them up, and you put them all together, and that's your signature. The signature is just the checksums of each of the blocks concatenated together to be a lump. The overall size of this is about, say, 1% of the file, of the order of magnitude. There's various maths you can do to work out what the optimal size is, depending on various assumptions, which are never valid. But the of the order, yeah, rule of thumb is about 1%. Okay. The next part of the algorithm is signature search. So you do the signature generation, and you send the signatures to the other end, to the guy who's got the new file. Right? So you do the signature generation on the old file. Send those across. So you've used one half of your round trip already. So I said rather meanly to the first suggestion here that I only wanted one round trip, right? Adding a condition to the problem, which is a classic way of doing things. So we send that, and we've got one half of our round trip gone already, so we've only got one send left, and we're done. What we do then is we now have to search for blocks from the old file that are present in the new file at any offset. And that's the trick. You have to find them at any offset at all, any byte offset, because that way you handle arbitrary insertions and deletions. Okay? Otherwise, you'd only handle block size. It'd be fine for VMS with record-based type file systems, but it'd be terrible for Unix, where things tend to be byte-oriented. Okay? Now, that search algorithm is the it uses this rolling hash, and what it does is it takes the hash and rolls it along the new file, calculating the weak rolling hash checksum at each byte offset, looks that up in a little hash table, and if the weak checksum matches, the rolling checksum matches, then it goes and calculates the strong checksum. If the strong checksum and the weak checksum match, then you assume you've got a block match and you've found a common block between the old and new file. Then you've got a simple encoding mechanism to encode that information back to the receiver, okay, the guy with the old file. Okay, so we can reconstruct the new file from this encoded data. Now, what does that look like? Let's have a look. So here's a bit of a diagram of how this turns out. Now, what we've got a little pointer here somewhere. Nope, I just use a finger. Okay. What we've got is, this is the old file sitting up there, file A, and that consists of these chunks of data. Now, I've just drawn them with different hashes. Thanks, Bad Dog, great. Look at how to use it. So, this crosshash goes this way, down to the left, assume that that's the same as this one down here, which also goes down to the left, right? And this one here, which is a little brick-like, that's the same lump of data as that brick-like one over there. That's what the little diagram is supposed to mean. It's all very obvious, I hope. Okay, so here's our new file, and here's our old file, and this is the resulting difference, which gets sent over the wire. And the resulting difference, the first block of the new file doesn't exist in the old file, so we have to send it as literal data. We have to send that over the wire. Right, because that data does not exist in the old file, therefore the information is not present on the receiving computer. You've got to get it there somehow. It's basically got to go over the wire. Right? There are second order things you can do. You can do things like compression on this, no problem. Rsync does that. If you use the minus Z option, it'll compress that. And there's some tricks you can do to make that compression go especially well and things, but basically you've got to send it. But this second lump of data in the new file is the same as this lump over here, which is just in a different position in the old file. Okay, so the search algorithm will find a match between this little block here and this block here, and will emit a token. And the token is just a index into the index and count, or whatever you want to encode it as. It's RLL type encoded, RLE encoded in rsync, token, which represents the match from the old file, the location, which is saying at the destination, when you're reconstructing this new file, shove out this literal block of data, then go and fetch token number 0123 from the old file and shove that out. Then we see the next lump of data, this hash here, is the same as that hash over there, so we set another token. Then there's another token, and then this little lump of data is another lump of literal data. That's that lump of literal data which doesn't exist anywhere in the old file. So what we end up with is the difference going over the wire is alternately lumps of literal data and tokens representing lumps of data from the old file. Okay, so that's our difference, right? And we can generate that from the searching for these signature blocks in the file, and that's all fine. So it's actually not really that magic when it comes down to it, which is why people work it out in a few minutes and why it took me several years. But it's very easy to code. You can code up the rsync algorithm in a matter of a few hundred lines of code. You can make it fast in not much more than that. And so you should be using it in all your programs. Okay, so let's go into a little bit more deeply. Signature generation. The file is divided into uniform blocks on the receiving end. Now, it has to be uniform blocks if you want to make this thing at all efficient. I'll let you think about that yourselves. I know people here will be already thinking, how could I do it non-uniform blocks, optimize it? There are ways of doing non-uniform blocks, but only if you're willing to handle more than one pass, or you're willing to increase the amount of signature data gets sent over the wire considerably. So in because latency, those of you who've done much network programming will know that latency is at least as important as bandwidth, if not more important, particularly if you're in Australia. And bandwidth, really can be quite cheap, but latency is often a killer. And so I really wanted to keep the latency to an absolute minimum, so I wanted to keep it down to one round trip total. Of course, TCP throws extra, with its windowing and its ACKs and all that, but at least because of the windowing and the smarts in TCP, the costs of the extra round trips and things aren't really that high, whereas logical round trips up at the algorithm level would be a killer. A good demonstration of that is, if you look in, I think it's chapter 3 of my thesis, I've got a little table where I show the speed of rsyncing 1,000 small files, like 1-byte files, versus FTP versus RCP. And rsync was like 2 seconds, FTP and, this is over a modem, FTP and RCP took off the order of like minutes, right? It's enormous difference. And that wasn't the rsync algorithm doing anything, because it can't do anything on a 2-byte or 1-byte file. It was the fact that it was saving latency. The fact that it was using one round trip for all 1,000 files rather than doing one round trip per file. So a lot of the time when people find rsync fast, it's actually not because of the algorithm underneath it. It's because it saves latency. Okay, anyway, it's divided into uniform blocks. On each block, we calculate 2 checksums, one of which has this special rolling property. Okay. Additionally, we also calculate a whole file strong checksum. Why do we do that? Yep. To make sure we reconstruct the file. Do we actually need that? You could have a bad link, but we're already doing checksums. Well, we need... the first version of algorithm of rsync didn't have this. And yet, I can assure you the first version would not fail. It won't fail in the lifetime of this universe anyway, except for bugs. There are plenty of those, but it won't fail due to the algorithm. Why not? Yeah, but if it's the same to begin with, then the algorithm will be very, very efficient because the difference will be just a bunch of tokens and it'll run length encode those. It'll be like 4 bytes. So that's not a problem. The reason the whole file strong checksum is needed is so you can cheat on the block checksums. We can use a really short block checksums. If you use something like a full MD4 per block, 128 bits per block, then there would be no point at all in having the whole file checksum. Because you're already doing a 128-bit checksum per block. Right? But 128 bits per block, 16 bytes per block, is very expensive. That's a lot of checksum data. It means you'd have to have large blocks in order so your checksums don't swamp the link. So instead, what you do is you trim down the size of the checksum per block. You make it really small. Which means that there's a small probability that the algorithm will fail. You have to catch that. And you catch that with the whole file checksum, which you can do at the same time, calculate at the same time with nice caching properties, etc., as you're doing the individual block checksums. And that way you know when you're screwed up. And in fact, it turns out that it's extremely rare this is needed anyway, because the rolling checksum is actually quite strong. It doesn't need to be that strong, but it just turned out the algorithm I used, which is a derivative of the Adler checksum, is it's a 32-bit checksum, two 16-bit halves. It has an effective strength of about 28 bits, which isn't bad for a rolling checksum. There are better ones, though. Somebody in the defence in Australia came up with ones that has about an effective strength of about 31.5 out of 32, but it's a bit more expensive to calculate. Anyway, so you need this so that you can use a small block checksum, and the current versions of rsync use a 16-bit 16-bit block checksum plus the 32-bit rolling checksum, giving you a total of 48, effective strength of about 46, which is still plenty so that none of you, if you're running rsync all the time, have probably ever noticed a resend and using the strong checksum, but it's there because it will happen once every 100 years or so, so you've got to make sure that you do catch it when it does. Okay, the signatures are sent to the sending side, obviously, and the optimal size depends on the data, although the dependency is a fairly flat one. If you look at a graph of optimal size, I'll get to it in a second, optimal size of the signature versus the signature size versus the total data transmitted, the efficiency of it, it's a relatively flat graph. So you can play with it on the command line at rsync with a minus B option. Rsync's got optionitis quite badly. You can play with that if you want to, but you'll find that it's a relatively flat graph, except in some particular types of data, then playing with that can give you massive improvements. Yep.
Why do you use MD4? Why not something simple like CRC16?
Primarily as a PR stunt. When rsync first came out, nobody trusted it. Everyone said, it can't work, this is going to fail all the time, the probability of failure is blah and blah, and there's all these people saying it's not going to work, right? So me being able to tell them that rsync failing is equivalent of breaking MD4 gives them a nice warm feeling in the tummy, right? The fact is that no one is attacking the transfer, yeah, right? Because they're not attacking the transfer, a CRC is ideal, right? And in fact, I would have used a CRC if it wasn't for the fact that users wouldn't have trusted it. Okay, but you're right, from a mathematical point of view, a CRC would be far more appropriate, but MD4 is actually very fast. It's quite a bit faster than MD5. I already had one lying around that I'd written for Samba, because you need it for the encryption stuff in Samba, and it also meant that I felt very confident that I was transferring the right data, that it wasn't, particularly when I wasn't using a whole file checksum. Now, I could, for example, now go to a CRC per block, go to an MD4 for the whole file checksum, and that would be fine, because then I can still say it's equivalent to breaking MD4, but why bother? It's really, that is not the bottleneck. In fact, the bottleneck, when people use the Z option, 90% of the CPU is in the gzip, the zlib library. Yep, Lee?
You talked about the possibility of failure being maybe 1 in 100 years.
Oh, much, much, much higher than that. That's if the probability of it using, even needing the strong checksum. Yeah. The probability of failure is about 1 in 10 to the 11 years if you... I've got a slide on that, but basically this universe will be long dead before the algorithm fails.
Okay. How did you test that? How do you know the resend code works?
Oh, I know, exactly. Willie's right. You have to test. Code that isn't tested is broken. Everyone knows that, right? If you haven't tested your code, then it doesn't work. So what I did was I dropped it back to a 2-bit weak checksum, and I tried 2-bit and 4-bit and 5-bit and various ones, which meant the probability of the resend was much, much higher, and I got it to resend every hour or so, that way I was able to test that the resend code does in fact work. In fact, I even did one of the releases of rsync accidentally had a 1-byte, I think, because I'd left the constant wrong from some experimentation. Didn't matter though, it's just, but anyway. So maybe it actually got tested by somebody else apart from me, which is good. Yeah, deliberate, of course. That's basically how it works. And a failure probability, yes, here it is. You can work out, there was a rather amusing email I got from one particular person worried about his data. He said, no, we can't do this. Look, the probability of failure is huge. It'll happen all the time. And he had this great long page of maths. He said, if we assume this and this sort of data and blah, 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 maths, long page, came to the bottom, it will fail in approximately 10 to the power of 49 years. Oh, I suppose that's okay. I'm glad he still hit send, because that was quite cute. Anyway, he was actually off. It's actually a his math was a bit off, but it's a massive number. Basically, the universe is thought to be about 10^10 years old, and if you assume 1 million transfers per second of a 1 megabyte file constantly, then you end up with about 1 in 10^11 years, approximately. So it's a big number. Yeah, there's a question over here. Yeah. Yep.
What exactly do you do to recover it? Just give up and send the whole file?
No, what I do is I resend with the full 128-bit per block, and I seed the checksum differently each round, right, based on... So I use a different seed for the checksum algorithm. What I do is with MD4, I put a seed at the front of the MD4 and MD4 hash the data plus the extra seed at the front, which means... It would have to, even if there was some particular failure mode of MD4 in the block algorithm, it's going to be a different seed every time. And but the only way you can tell is you see the file name twice. But the file name twice can happen under other circumstances. If you've seen this happen, it's almost certainly because the file changed during transfer, because rsync does no locking. Okay, which means that if you're modifying the file while it's being transferred, then probably the checksum will fail and it will go round again. And if it goes round twice and it still fails, then it prints a message saying, error checksum failed. What does it say? Error checksum failed, file changed during transfer, ? And it's probably a file, like a log file, that's been constantly updated, and so the checksums didn't match because it was, it's never going to be able to get it exact. It means that what you got at the other end is something that will approximate, some snapshot of the file, but because it's not doing any locking, it can't guarantee that it's got a particular snapshot of the file, because you can't have an atomic read of a whole file.
Why is it it's no locking?
Sorry?
Why is it it's no locking?
Because nobody submitted a patch for locking yet. No, it doesn't do locking for a number of reasons. Locking is cooperative in Unix, and it'd have to cooperate with some other locking scheme. Which locking scheme? I could F-lock it, I could do something like that. What do I do if it's locked? Do I then block the whole transfer? And people use this in cron, etc. What I'm thinking of doing for a future version is having a locking option, --- locking equals flock, --- locking equals mailbox, --- locking equals something, various schemes, and you can drop in different locking schemes if you want to. If you're silly enough to use mandatory locks, you could even make it actually work properly. Locking just... Unix really doesn't use much locking. So Unix tools don't tend to lock stuff. CP doesn't lock and other tools don't lock. But you're right that it could be nice in some cases to do locking, particularly if you're transferring known types of data when you know the locking style of that data, like mailboxes. Yep. What I tend to do for mailboxes, in fact, all of my mail gets delivered and sent using rsync. I've got an rsync-based mailer. And it's a tiny little shell script. I should show it. A thing called mail scripts in Pubtridge Misc on samba.org. A couple hundred lines of shell, and it does send, receive, SSH, transfer, all sorts of nice stuff. It's actually quite a nice little mailer. Plug number, whatever. It uses that. In fact, what it does is it calls, inside the rsync, it calls the move mail. And that, of course, does all the right locking stuff and atomic and, wondrous things. Okay, so that's that. Some of you may not realize you can actually do a lot of things with the rsync got optionitis, as I mentioned earlier. It's got a lot of options. One of the cute things you can do, people get asking for things like, okay, please, can you add an option to rsync to run this command on completion? Well, no, because you can do that already, because there's the rsync path option, which says where to find rsync on the remote end. Now, the thing on the remote end only has to look like rsync. It doesn't actually be rsync. So it can be a shell script wrapper that runs rsync in the middle, checks the error code, and does various things at the end. That's how my mailer works. Therefore, you can run arbitrary commands on the completion of rsync, successful completion of rsyncs, by using the rsync path option to specify a program other than rsync that happens to call rsync and send it a standard in, standard out at the other end. So anyway, that's those of you who like playing with shell scripts might like that. Okay, the actual rsync program has a bunch of other features which make it a useful tool, which are completely orthogonal to the algorithm. Particular things, latency-saving design, I spent 8 years studying at the other end of a modem from where all my data was, and so I tended to worry about latency. And often my stuff was in the other side of the world as well, so I really cared about latency. So it cares a lot about latency. Fancy file list handling, excludes, skipping files, that sort of thing. SSH support, people seem to like that a lot. That's very useful, giving you secure transfers. And thank God OpenSSH has finally got non-blocking I.O. That was a major pain with rsync, the blocking I.O. and various bugs with pipes in various kernels and operating systems and things. Finally, OpenSSH 2.1 and above does non-blocking I.O., which means rsync works much better. So if any of you are using rsync over SSH, then definitely grab the latest OpenSSH. Things work a lot better, a lot more smoothly. Daemon mode, rsync is now becoming quite a common distribution tool for various places. A lot of sites that have FTP sites now also have rsync sites. It sort of exports shares and that sort of thing. Incremental backup is one that a lot of people aren't aware of. Rsync actually can be used as an incremental backup tool, including doing like rotating backups and all sorts of things like that using the backup dir option. I should put up some more examples of that on the rsync site, but we use it for all our backups. We have a backup server in the office, and then rsync has built in the capability to say, okay, update this remote directory as a backup, but then any of the changed files, deleted files, put them in this incremental directory, and that way you can have like a 7-day rotating backup and that sort of thing, which is quite useful. But a lot of people aren't aware of that. And in all of this stuff, the significance of the actual underlying, signature algorithm, search algorithm, really has been lost. Actually, I probably should... wonder how much power I've got left in this. I just don't want it to embarrassingly turn off all in the middle of the talk. Oh, boy, power. Where's the plug? I'm about to lose. Otherwise, I've got a physic coming. I better suspend. Where is it? This. Ah, great. Okay. Oop. Right, saved. I hope. Battery charging? Yes, 0%. Okay, we just made it. Okay, that was close. It was this light flashing. I wonder what it meant. And he just got this laptop. Right. Okay, other uses for the algorithm. Now, rsync is now starting to get used in a few other places, which is really good. I'm hoping it's going to be used in a lot more places, though. Perhaps the most important one is rproxy, which is embedding rsync into the HTTP algorithm, and I'll talk about that in a second. Then there's also some effort underway to embed rsync inside CVS. Rsync as part of a WAN file system is one of my favourites, and rzip is something I developed, which is really an academic interest. It's a very good compressor. It does much better compression, particularly for large files, than anything else I've seen, but it's extraordinarily slow. Really, really slow. But if you really need that extra compression, you've got a few weeks to spare, then it can be good. Hours anyway. So I'll just talk about some of these a little bit to give you a bit of an idea of sort of things you can do with this. Rsync in HTTP is one of the most important ones, and that's nearing the point where it's ready for release. It's a thing called rproxy. And it's being developed by another guy in Linux Care in Canberra. And what this does is basically think of the history of the internet, the web. Of course, the internet is the web. Yeah. Think of the history of the web. Basically, we started off uncached. Everyone just had a browser, the old browsers. Then caches were invented because it made things much faster. And then CGI came along and everything got slow again. Basically, one of the big problems is there's this massive cache infrastructure worldwide, right? People have squids everywhere and hierarchies of squids and NetApp caches and all these sort of things. The problem is that they're all completely useless for dynamic content. And yet, the world is moving towards dynamic content at a very fast rate. Probably by volume of data transferred, the majority of data on the web is already dynamic. Or at least it's getting that way. So how do we solve this? Well, what we can do is you can actually... There's a couple of proposals to solve this. Some people are proposing to in the markup, in the HTML or XML itself, you mark up sections that are static and sections that are dynamic, etc. Problem is, website designers are inherently lazy or brain dead or something, I don't know, something about them. But if we can't even convince website designers not to put 4 megabyte images on their home pages, how are we going to convince them to put in the markup sections for dynamic and non-dynamic and get them right? It's too much effort. We really have to do it in the tools, so it just happens. That's, I don't think those markups things are really a practical solution for wide range, really big use. The other types of solutions, there's a solution being proposed at the moment, HTTP Delta. Unfortunately, it really relies on storing all outgoing pages. Having some sort of database or repository where you store all pages that you send, so you then run a diff against the, then they send a tag ID to say which page they've got in their cache, and then you can generate a difference. The thing is that I run a fairly large website myself, and I just don't like the idea of every page that I send I have to store on local disk, because I send a lot of pages. Storing all those pages would be a great pain. So what Async and HTTP does is it solves the problem by allowing only the differences to go over the wire without having to store the old files using this exact same algorithm. So what you do, it has all the nice features. It builds on the existing web infrastructure. You know, sounds like a sales pitch. All the content is cacheable, whether it's CGI, whatever. Any content becomes cacheable. And there's no extra round trips, because extra round trips would be deadly. We've got enough of them already with TCP handshakes and all that. So what you can do with Async and HTTP is the client, imagine the client has a cached file. Let's assume that we haven't got a chicken and egg. We've already got a cached file there. We've cached some CGI file. Okay. The client generates the signature from that cached file and adds it to the request as an Async signature header in the request for the new, to re-requesting the file, the same page, right? Adds this header. It's Base64 encoded or whatever. Then the server generates the page as usual. So the server runs its usual CGI generation stuff. Then just before it's going to stick it on the wire, it says, "Ooh, did the incoming request have this async signature header? Oh, it did. Then I can generate a diff." Because it can use that signature plus the new page to generate the diff from the old page. Because it doesn't need access to the old page to generate the diff. The signature will do the job. So it generates the page as usual, does the checksum search, and generates the async differences. Then it sends the async differences as content-encoded async and decodes it to give the new page, sends it back to the client. The client decodes it, and it shoves the new page in its cache. And this actually works. Works very nicely, and I get massive speed-ups. I've been running this for a little while at home. Across my modem link. I run it for the last hop across the modem. I've now got ISDN, so I actually haven't bothered running it for a little while. But it reduced the traffic over my modem link for web surfing in general over a 2-week period by 90%, which is a fairly large reduction. The fact that I threw gzip over the top of it as well helped. It got some of that, but a fair bit of it was in fact the improvements in from the algorithm. And the rproxy project is a project to do this properly. I just did a rough prototype, and Martin Poole, who's been working on Apache for quite a while, is now working on building this into Apache and doing it as a separate proxy, plus possibly doing patches for Mozilla, but we haven't started looking into that yet, and also doing patches for Squid. And the idea is that eventually you have it in your Squid server, you have it in your web server, and then you end up with just sending differences for CGI pages between the web server and your local Squid. The advantage of doing that, of course, is that if your browser doesn't understand this extension, you still get the benefit. Because the way we've organized it is that you get the benefit between the two furthest distant points in the chain, in the HTTP chain between client and server, that understand the extension. Right? So if the server and your Squid both understand it, you get the advantage. If the second level Squid and the first level Squid understand it, but the server and client don't, you get the advantage for the hop between the two Squids. So if you've got some slow link or whatever, you can put one of these things over it and reduce the data going over that section.
Exactly. It seems to me that this really only benefits talking about dynamic content, it seems to me it benefits transatlantic, trans-Pacific proxy caching efforts, but it really doesn't do anything at all for the... In fact, it doesn't even for, you know, pages that are static and maybe are mostly static and change, you know, weekly or something like that. But it doesn't really mean that my impression is that the bottleneck for most of those dynamic contents is that those CGIs are just too slow.
No. If you have a look at something like, you go to something like CNN.com, right? The page remains exactly the same every time except for about 8 bytes, right? They have this little ID that ticks over on every page, okay? Which means that with current technology, you're resending that 150 kilobytes every time. Now, the generation of it, you can solve the generation problem by just getting a faster CPU. But it's relatively cheap to get a faster CPU. We'll just get more of them. Have a farm. But it's harder to get a fast network link. What this does is it allows you to trade off between CPU speed and network speed. This costs you some CPU speed. It's actually quite fast. You can saturate a 10 megabit network quite happily with a fast enough CPU you can saturate 100. If you've got a bit of CPU grunt to spare, but you haven't got a particularly fast network link, then you can use some of that CPU to reduce the amount of bandwidth you need.
Yeah, I can see it over 28.8 modem
Come and live in Australia for a while. It's not for everyone. You don't want to use it on the intranet, right? It's just going to be a waste of CPU on the intranet. There's an awful lot of places. I've heard something about a lot of people in the US have DSL. It's something like 30% of households have access to DSL or could have DSL if they wanted to in the US. It's like 0% in Australia or close to it. But the other 70%, of course, could benefit for this sort of thing. You know, getting that last mile to the end user, this could actually benefit quite a lot. And of course, you don't have to turn it on. It's just a feature. Async and CVS, Ben Ellison's working on that. Hopefully it's going to be done any day now for the past several months. It's that sort of project. Async in a WAN file system, this is quite interesting. You can combine Async with lease-based file systems to do... I was wondering what the... How am I going on time? Running over? No? Oh, heaps. Okay. You combine Async with a WAN-based file system. Now, lease file systems, it's a bit like the stuff in NFS v4, where basically the client can take a lease out on the file and do write caching and read caching of the file. Now, imagine you had a WAN file system, like a global file system, where you're reading your mail from a machine in the US and you're sitting in Australia, and you load your 10 megabyte mailbox. Okay, you subscribe to Linux kernel. So you've got this massive mailbox, and you bring it up, and then you delete one message out of it, right? And then you save the mailbox again. Okay, now with normal network file systems, what you would have to do is send that whole 10 megabyte file, chug, 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 back to the server, because you've written a modified file. The length has changed, everything's changed about it. Right, but if you've got a lease on the file, then what will happen is those writes will initially go into the page cache on the client. So you have in the page cache on the client, you have the new file. In the page cache on the server, you will have the old file. So you have two lumps of data, and you have a low bandwidth, high latency link between them. What do? You synchronize the page caches between the client and the server using the async algorithm. What that means is that what goes over the wire is just a few bytes, because it says, oh, all of this part of the file was the same, and all of that's the same, and there's these few bytes that are missing. Okay? And notice one of the things, by the way, I didn't point this out earlier about the async algorithm, very different to diff. Diff only handles insertions and deletions. Right? Have any of you noticed that if you say move a routine in a file, then you send the diff, what it does is it says minus, minus, minus this one, and plus, plus, plus that one. If you use ed-style diffs, then it just means, you know, edit out that bit, then add this bit. It repeats the whole chunk in its new location. And that's because it can only handle inserts and deletes, and it encodes everything in terms of inserts and deletes. Whereas what you actually have is a move of a lump of data in the file, you can't encode that with a diff-style algorithm. Rsync encodes that as a move, because it just says, this token is at that location. So you can handle arbitrary moves, which is particularly good for remote file systems. You say sorted the file, or you've done something weird to it, you've moved a chunk of data around, you resaved the file, it will encode that. Of course, it also handles binary files quite well. Thing about gzipped files, I could, if I've got a second, I can tell you about those. Your question?
With your WAN file system there.
It doesn't exist yet, but at the moment,
well,
yeah.
In theory, though, there's a significant problem here. You're saying that updates to the file maintain a gauge cache, and I presume the rsync algorithm that's sending the updates to the file server occur at when the file is closed.
When it's flushed. Typically, with leaf space systems, you flush every 30 seconds or minute or whatever. Yeah, but you're worried about turning off the power and losing it.
Well, no, I was more thinking if you make so many updates to the file between F open and F close, you can fill out your gauge cache.
Hang on, but if the data's in memory, right? It doesn't record the changes you've made. No, it's not like there are other algorithms, there are other systems where what they do is they record all the edits, right? Then they send the edits as an edit list, which can become infinitely large. You've made a large number of edits. That's not how it works. Okay? It's when you save the file, you've got the whole file as the new file. Then you've got the old file at the other end. You don't have the list of edits available to you, right? Because to have the list of edits, you need to instrument all your applications. You don't want to instrument your applications. So what this, you've got this lump of data at one end, you've got the new file, the old file is a lump of data at the other, and all you're doing is using this as a fast way of getting the old data to equal the new data. Yep. Yep, Dave?
So it sounds like an interesting project would be RSync.
Yeah, it's really, the thing is contexts are a problem. You don't basically, you can't get contexts.
Well, that's
X-Delta. Have you seen X-Delta?
Yes.
Okay, X-Delta was basically, it's an rsync-inspired delta algorithm. It's a very nice delta algorithm. It works really well on binaries, works really well on, produces very, very small differences. It was originally based on the rsync algorithm. The thing is, because it's a local differencing algorithm, he's got high bandwidth between the old and the new file. So he was able to tweak it and tweak it and tweak it and tweak it. And now, really, it's nothing like the rsync algorithm. It's really only inspired by it. If you want a local differencing algorithm, use X-Delta. It's a hell of a lot better than using a local rsync because he knows that both are local, he can do all sorts of tricks to make it really fast. It's in fact, it'll give approximately the same differences if you ran rsync with minus B 4, block size of 4 bytes. That's where I want to build it into CVS. You see, inside CVS, there is a file send operation, right? And that's the file send operation, at the other end, you have available the best guess of the old file. It doesn't have to be the old necessarily be the old file, it just has to be your best guess at it, the last revision or whatever, okay? Then what you do is inside the file send method, inside CVS, you go file send rsync method. You don't call out to rsync, you just call the library. And that's what Ben's adding to CVS. Yeah, that's right. It's got both files then, and it runs diff. Yeah. And so that's what Ben's adding. And he's adding it. It doesn't just help. It helps annotate. It helps diff. It helps commit. It helps lots of different... Anywhere inside CVS, if you do a CVS minus T trace, where you see sending file blah, those bits get sped up. Yep. Questions?
Are there any special issues involved in copying directories to directories?
I'm sorry, the... Oh, well, the rsync tool has all sorts of options, does recursive and knows about, I don't know, symlinks and directories and devices and inodes. And rsync is quite commonly used. In fact, I did an install when I changed hard disk on my laptop from one hard disk to the other, right, just rsync from slash to slash and then boot. I just had to run LILO, okay? So it will handle all the different properties. It'll do devices and all those sort of things. And it knows about directory hierarchies and hard links and all that sort of stuff. The hard link support is optional. We have to add minus capital H, but it's a bit slow. The algorithm for doing hard links is a bit horrible, but it knows all about directories and things.
Right.
Yeah,
and that's sort of obvious once you think it through.
There are some tricks to it. Main thing is latency saving tricks. If you've got a whole tree of a million files, you don't want a million round trips. You don't even want one round trip per directory. So what it does is, in fact, it's one logical send for the whole tree. Right. one logical send of a stream of signatures, and there's, in fact, there's three processes. It forms a little triangle of processes where you've got at one end of the link the generator and the receiver. The generator is generating signatures on the tree as fast as it can and stuffing it down the link. The sender at the other end is receiving those signatures and generating the differences and sending it back to the receiver at the other end. The receiver is having differences being thrown out as fast as it can and generating the new files, which means the whole thing's one logical round-trip pipelined for the whole tree, which is why rsync works really well for large trees, because of the latency savings with small files. Also, the way it encodes the file list, transferring the file names, it has various tricks. It ends up encoding them as approximately 10 bytes per file, including all of the various size information and things. It has a bit to say this is the same device number as the previous file. It has a byte which says that how many bytes are in common between this file name and the previous file name, that sort of thing. So it packs it and compresses it and this sort of thing. So there's various tricks in there. I went a bit mad, actually, and tried to save every bit, and it was a mistake, because several people have asked about making this an IETF standard and doing some sort of RFC and that sort of thing. The format on the wire is too horrible to put in a document, and because I tried to save every bit. When you save every bit, you end up with a very specialised format, and it was like rebelling against the SMB protocol. You know, I was doing something completely different. But instead, what I'd like to see, if we're going to make anything a standard, I'd like to see a new tool developed on top of librsync, which is much, much cleaner, and that uses a sensible encoding. Rather than this saving every bit encoding. Yep. Is there other questions? Yep.
Compressed data, both stream compressed and block compressed data. How does rsync work on those files?
Okay, compressed data. Basically, the rsync program works fine on compressed files, right? The actual binary, whatever, it works fine, but the rsync algorithm is not very efficient on compressed files. Okay? And the reason for that, it depends on the type of compression, but most compression algorithms, if you change the first byte of the file, then every byte of the compressed file beyond that point gets changed. Okay, now, there's an easy workaround, right? You could just send the whole file. There's two workarounds. One that everyone tends to suggest is, why don't you uncompress the file, send the compressed differences of the uncompressed file, then recompress at the other end? And the reason I don't do that is, sure, you will get the right uncompressed data at the other end, but you won't end up with an identical compressed file because you won't necessarily have the exact same revision of zlib at the both ends. So a different revision of zlib will decompress the file, no problem, but it will compress it differently. It'll have different options. It won't necessarily produce the same compressed stream, which means, sure, you will transfer the correct compressed data, but the MD5 checksum of the two files may not be the same. And that is a problem. Because if people started using rsync to distribute RPMs and they came up with a different MD5 checksum or TAR-GZs or whatever after the transfer, everyone would lose faith in rsync. Right? So there's a way you can get around this, but it requires a small tweak to gzip or vzip or whatever the compression algorithm is. And the gzip one is easiest to explain. Gzip has a 32K buffer, history buffer. Okay. Now, gzip uses dynamic Huffman encoding, which means if you change one byte in the file, everything after that point in the file changes in the compressed data. Problem. That means, of course, that rsync will be terrible, okay, unless the change is towards the end of the file. Right? But what you can do is, inside the gzip algorithm, you keep a rolling hash. We've got an earthquake, haven't we? Yeah? A truck. Oh, okay. Inside the gzip algorithm, you maintain a rolling hash of the last, say, 100 bytes or 300 bytes or whatever number of kilobytes. In fact, about 10 kilobytes would probably be optimal. Say the last 10 kilobytes rolling hash. And you roll that along while you're doing the gzip. Now, whenever that rolling hash equals a particular number, and zero is a good number, okay, then you reset the internal compression tables of gzip. What that means is that the differences don't propagate more than 10 kilobytes on average. Right? So what you end up with is, if you say, that's if you're using a 10-bit rolling hash, okay? Then a 10-bit rolling hash will mean it's 1 kilobyte, but, you know, whatever. 12-bit, 11-bit, whatever. It's a tiny tweak to the gzip algorithm. It's one I've been meaning to submit to the gzip maintainers and to zlib people. to basically make gzip rsync friendly. And it doesn't affect the compression ratio much at all. Very, very small difference in the compression ratio. But it does mean that you've got a 50 megabyte tar gz file and you've got a different version of that tar gz file, then rsync will do very, very well on that. And it will find it will end up with a very small transfer. So that's a proposed change. In the case of bzip, you do the same thing, but with a longer... What you do is, in bzip, you select the block size. Normally, you select on the command line, it's like 900k, or in fact, that minus 9 means 900k, minus n means n times 100k, right? What you do is you set the... keep a rolling hash of about the length of that block size. You basically you restart the blocks. So you have to do a larger block in that case. It'll only be as useful for really big files. Do a larger block and you reset the bzip tables at the end of when the rolling hash equals zero in each case. Yep. And when you do that, you don't keep your dynamic Huffman tables between blocks. Yep, Willie?
You talked earlier about the hierarchy, you treat all as one big thing.
Yeah.
Does this mean you can actually cope with a file that's renamed?
Coping with files that are renamed is partly in there. It's called the fuzzy option, minus minus fuzzy. It's in the CVS tree partly. It's broken, doesn't work yet. I started coding it a few weeks ago. The idea is to cope with renames, so it's for Debian trees, that sort of thing, where basically, you know, I should call it minus minus Debian option, where basically you've got... you put out your deb files or your source files or whatever, and the file name changes every time you put it out. And so what it does is I've got various heuristics for finding the closest matched file name to use for the signatures. And it looks first in the current directory for files with at least like 6 characters in common and various other stupid heuristics. And the idea is that it will find files that have a similar name that have been renamed. If you want to actually handle arbitrary renames, it's very expensive because you need to be able to search for the signatures across all of the files in the directory. Across, it's an n squared problem, and it's expensive. But handling rename to similarly named files is easy, or doing it on the command line. If you have an option to say this file equals that file, in fact, you can handle renames now. If you want to do it all on the command line, you can just say rsync this file to that file name, and it's quite happy about having different file names at either end.
Yeah.
Is that what you were asking about?
No, sorry. I must have misunderstood how you said it worked, because I thought you treated it as if it was one large file.
No, I don't treat it as one large file. Okay. It's just that I pipeline the signatures from each of the individual files.
Okay.
Yep. Yep.
What if you transfer like directories recursively, if you treat it, or you make a tar file of the directory and then rsync that?
You could indeed do that. But it wouldn't give you the nice properties. It'd take an awful lot of disk space at the other end to store the tar file, then unpack it.
Yeah.
The way rsync works at the moment is that when it's the destination file is created as a temporary file, a dot file, then it's renamed atomically at the end over the file. You can rsync tar files. In fact, for my thesis, that's what I did. If you look in my thesis, all my results are for rsyncing of tar files. And the reason for that is all I was interested in was the algorithm, not all the associated garbage of directory handling and all that. So to get rid of all that, I just transferred one file. But I didn't. I wanted it to be a realistic file, so I did tar files with the Linux kernel and Emacs and things like that. So, in fact, doing tar files is perfectly sensible. Although, don't make the block size 512 bytes. You get various things with tar files at 512 byte offsets. Yep, Dave.
Another interesting thing you can do to handle the unique situation is to use the IO numbers.
Right, yes. I could indeed do that. I hadn't thought of that. Yes. But the if it's hang on the inode number, which inode number are you going to match? Because you don't have the old inode if you're doing between two machines. But if you got the master file, if you got the master file on the same, you would have had to have cached. You've had to have done some ls minus li previously and stored that somewhere. You don't have the old inode number. You have to scan the tree on one machine. On the other machines, you have the new scan tree on both machines. You don't have the old scan tree on the destination, which means you don't have the old old inode number. You'd have to have some forethought, and the the administrator would have had to have done at LS minus LI and stored the inode number somewhere. I do send inode numbers when I'm when I'm doing hard links. If you use the capital H option, it sends device and inode numbers because that's how it detects hard links. I'm not. Maybe we should talk about it after. I'm not quite sure that it works. Yep.
How well does the rsync algorithm work for really huge files? You mentioned it requires about 1% of the file size.
Yeah. What you do is the optimal. It works fine for big files. Optimally, you should scale the block size as the square root of the file size. In practice, I scale it linearly with the file size. And what happens is, as you get a really, really big file, you get a really big block size, which means you don't see small matches between the two files. And the reason I scale it like that is because I like the fact that rsync with its default options will never be worse than 1% over sending the whole file. Okay, because the signatures are approximately 1% of the data length. Whereas if you scale it according to the mathematically optimal, which is approximately square root of file length, then the problem is that the worst case becomes quite bad in the case of very large files. You can end up with, you know, quite a large percentage over the case of just sending the file. But you can tune that on the command line. There are some cases, if people are doing very large DNS, you know, millions of machines DNS type stuff, zone files, and they're doing a lot of updates on them, then, for example, you might want to set a smaller block size than the default, because if you know something of the structure of the file, and you know that there are records in the file of approximately n bytes in length, approximately, then setting the block size a bit smaller than n is a good idea.
I guess my question is more involved with the RAM required to do the file reassembly. Do you always need at least 1% of the file size?
Oh, no. It rolls along the file with windowing thing. It doesn't require... It does require storing the signatures,
right.
But because it scales linearly, it's got an upper bound on the total memory it will use in that case. The main problem with the memory use of rsync is holding the file list. Because of the way I designed it, I didn't really design rsync for being used in the case of hundreds of millions of files with 4 megabyte machines. But people are using it that way. And the problem is that the internal storage, I store the whole file list and sort it, because it's really convenient having a sorted file list for various reasons, particularly hard links and things. I sort the file list, so I have to store it in memory. And... because of that, and the internal format uses approximately 100 bytes per file. So if you have a million files you're transferring, then it requires 100 megabytes of RAM approximately internally. Now that's expensive. On the wire, it only costs about 10 bytes per file. But I use an unpacked format for fast access in memory. Now I'm planning on fixing that. I posted something about 18 months or so ago, a year or so ago, to the rsync mailing list, how I can fix this. And it's a bit involved, but you can have a look on the rsync mailing list. There's, I think, a link to it on the rsync homepage. There's a way around this, but unfortunately it's fairly involved, which is partly why I've been avoiding doing it thus far. I've also been busy with various other things. But yeah, the memory usage is primarily in the holding of the file list. The size of the files is basically irrelevant to the memory usages of the program. Yeah, your page cache, of course, will get hit badly. Any other questions there? Yep?
I'm just curious about the three naming problem again. If you were to just send the file list at the beginning, followed by a large block of data corresponding to the contents of all the files, would that not just sort of automatically solve the renaming problem?
Well, no, but think about the order of magnitude of the problem of matching signatures to files. No, it's not really. You also need a much bigger block size to make it efficient. Yeah, there are various things you can do, but none of them are particularly appealing.
There's a conflict here between, on the one hand, as you said, wanting to send millions of files and do that efficiently, okay,
yeah,
in terms of overhead. On the other hand, the desire some people have of sending, you know, if you look at the any of the distribution,
yeah,
RPM,
yep,
only
1,000 files, yeah.
1,000
files. Yeah, and handling renames. You're right. You're right. In the case of a few hundred to a few thousand files, you could have an algorithm that would do much better with renames. And yes, that Handling renames is something I do want to do, because partly because of the stuff that Stephen's been doing with his apt proxy stuff, where he's actually done an rsync-based apt proxy system. Look for it as... I think it's called apt proxy, isn't it, Stephen? Where are you? I was not listening. Have a look at a fresh paper apt proxy. Handling renames and things for that would be quite cute. I'll just, last few minutes, get on with RZIP. RZIP is the compression algorithm. This is primarily of academic interest, but it's quite nice as far as the compression ratios it gets. RZIP is a rsync-inspired compression algorithm. It's not exactly the rsync algorithm inside it, but it has a lot in common with the rsync algorithm. Originally, it shared a lot of code, and then eventually it didn't for speed. But it does give some very nice results. These are the compression ratios on various files, a particular version of Emacs, that can get the versions out of my thesis, a particular version of Linux, my development home directory for Samba. So it's got lots of different versions of Samba in the same home directory, and a mail archive, and a collected spam from a 24-hour period on samba.org. notice 84 megabytes. Unfortunately, Samba.org, Samba at Samba.org, made it onto some spammer's CD-ROM. And so every spammer in the world hit us, and it was really quite awful. So this was the collected spam from a little period. Anyway, the compressor's very nice here, because people told me, you know, compressing spam is really easy. RM does it beautifully. If you actually do want to keep it for various analysis purposes, then this is great. So these are the compression ratios. Now, notice that RZIP wins... In all cases. In some cases, RZIP wins by a long, long way. For example, my home directory, my development area, my Samba development area, GZIP gets 3.50 compression ratio, BZIP2 gets 4.78, RZIP gets 8.93. Now, if you know anything about the compression literature, you'll know that getting a 10% improvement over something like BZIP is considered good. Getting a factor of 2 better is considered quite extraordinary. The reason is that RZIP, taking advantage of the rolling checksums and things, can use a massive history. GZIP uses a 32K history. BZIP by default uses a 900K history. RZIP by default uses a 250 megabyte history. Right? So if you have, say you're backing up home directory, slash home on a big system, and two people have got checked out copies of the Linux kernel, okay, and you GZIP a tar file of slash home, then when it comes to the second copy of the Linux kernel tree, 100 megabytes after the first one, it will say, oh, that's the same as this one back here with these small differences, and a few bytes goes out. Right? So it can find matching chunks of the order of hundreds of megabytes going back a quarter gig. And in fact, you can make it more than a quarter gig with some tweaks. And the way it does this, it's a bit like floating point. Normal GZIP-like algorithms, they're basically offset length algorithms. They're based on this, here's a match at offset this in the history and this length of match. Well, what I do is the offset has a mantissa and exponent portion, which means it is offset 2 to the power of this plus this, right? And the RZIP algorithm uses the rsync rolling checksums to find the matches. And it's very, very, very slow. But if you need to compress really big files and you think there's a lot of common data in it, like slash home or a spam file or something, then RZIP's probably, you know, good for you. And it's available in the RZIP CVS area. I've never released it to the world because it really is of academic interest primarily. I've just told a few compression places about it. But it is available. It's under the GPL if anyone wants to use it. Better than the compression, but still not good, but primarily because it's lousy code. It's academic code. It's written with instrumentation and things in it. As an example of what I mean by academic code in this particular case, it has built into it a BZIP-like, because it uses BZIP as this entropy coder on the back end. My implementation of BZIP is about 50 to 60 times slower than the one in BZIP 2. It's that sort of code. It's code that's clear, but not particularly fast. So if anyone wants to speed it up, then they can, although the speeding up the compression to be actually acceptably fast would, I think, be quite a hard task. I think, have I just about reached the end? More info there, you can go for more info. More info on rsync, you can get at rsync.samba.org. Rsync.org isn't my site, and I have no idea what it points at. Apparently there is an rsync.org, but anyway, somebody's grabbed it. linuxkernel.com/rproxy if you want to hear about rproxy, the HTTP accelerator. My home directory's got a copy of my thesis and things. There's a tech report there about rsync as well. Don't read the tech report, read the thesis instead. The thesis is clearer and more accurate. The tech report we wrote when Paul and I had only just started working on this stuff, and Paul McCarris was my supervisor at ANU. We worked on this stuff a bit together. The thesis is a far more readable and more accurate description of rsync. And if you want to actually check out some of the code that isn't released yet, like rzip and the latest version of rsync, then go to the CVS area on samba.org. Okay. Yep. Final.
A while ago, you had some musings, I think, about the problems of synchronizing many millions of files when there were not too many changes. I guess you had some plans for some kind of a hierarchical.
Yes, exactly. That's what I described earlier when I said of the ways of reducing the memory and improving things for certain common cases. People were starting to do things like rsync export, like mirror.rnet.edu.au, this massive FTP site, the equivalent of like SunSite or MetaLab in Australia, and exporting the whole tree. And the load on the server was quite high when you start an rsync of the whole tree. And additionally, the memory requirements are just far too high. And it can be fixed, I just haven't fixed it yet. Hopefully I'll fix it soon. I'm going to be using a little TDB database to store the cached copies of the directory trees, so I don't have to stat all the inodes all the time and bring all those pages into memory. And that will speed things up a lot for the launch time as far as scanning the file list. And then I've got this hierarchical idea, which does unfortunately add one round trip per element in the hierarchy, but that will improve things a lot as far as the size of file list in memory. Yeah, but it's not implemented yet, so I can't promise when it's going to be done. It just depends on what other things I'm working on. If somebody else wants to do it first, then submit the patch. Yep.
Do you have the server have pre-computed signatures?
No, because the client generates the signatures.
What if you did it the other way around?
You can do server-generated signatures, and you could do pre-computed with server-generated signatures. And there are some other reasons for doing server-generated signatures, one of the main ones being a patent concern. But unfortunately, it requires basically complete rewrite of rsync, and it won't be backwards compatible. Paul and I have been considering doing that. We may do it at some stage, and when we do go to server-generated signatures, we do have the possibility of doing caching of those. But while we're still doing client-generated signatures, within the current infrastructure of rsync, you can't do it. We would have to be basically a new program. Okay, final, yep, Charlie?
Can you be thinking about using a database of signatures to do incremental backup using rsync?
Yeah, that's I talk about that in my thesis a little bit. That's another application for rsync. You can do very nice incremental backup. It's ideal for like tape robots, tape robot backup. Say, for example, you've got a big tape silo, so you've got very, very slow access to the main data in your tape silo, but typically you've got a fast front-end disk, which is maybe a tenth of a percent of the total size of your tape archive. What you can do is your initial backup you store to the tape, but then you store the signatures of the files on tape on the front-end disks. Then when you do a subsequent backup, you can get just the differences without actually retrieving the old files off disk, off tape. You just retrieve the signatures, which are small, off disk, do the differencing using the rsync algorithm, then store the differences either to tape or to disk, probably to tape, because it's only a write. It'll be much faster than reading in all the data, and it'll be small. And that allows you to do very nice incremental tape backups with very, very little tape activity. And it's ideal. It would also be great for worm drives, CD worm drives, that sort of thing, where basically you store the original data, then you just add a little bit onto the end of the worm drive for the differences each time. It allows you to roll back to any version very nicely while storing minimum amount of data. You could make a really lovely backup system that way. So I'll expect the patches shortly. It really would be very nice. There was a company that was looking at doing it, I think, but it'd be nice if there was a nice GPL backup program that did this. Yep. Okay, thanks very much.
Trish?
Yep.
Are the changes to GZIP and VZIP2 to reason the compression algorithm available anywhere? Patches or?
No. Oh, somebody did them. They might be. Somebody did send them to me at one stage, but I think they're lost in my inbox. Unfortunately, my inbox.
Well, I mean, I don't think that there's a certain way you can break it too late. can in fact, I talk about this in my thesis, you can in fact async the file list. Right. What you do is you generate the file list as a reference. We already do that. And the file list will actually be very, very similar. In most async transfers, the file list is the majority of the data going out the list. Right. Because generally, it's not, you're asking regularly on an hourly basis, and the actual data changes aren't much. So but you're resending this potentially multi megabyte file list. Okay. What you do is you generate the file list to both ends. Then you run the async algorithm to synchronize the file list. So we end up recursively calling async algorithm after itself. It doesn't actually call the program, it's called the internal algorithm. And that, in fact, works extremely well. It's just a bit perverse. It's a little bit hard to debug. I haven't implemented it yet, but I did a test implementation when I was doing my thesis. So I proposed that as a way of saving and getting more bits in the transfer. And it was an obvious way to save lots more stuff. For my thesis, that sort of academic thing is useful. But then I couldn't decide when making the tool what is practical and what should stay in academia. And I decided that would stay in academia for the moment. It does make a lot of sense because very often the file is transferred.
Yesterday, finally, there was sitting there.
What I was suggesting, though, if you hire this RSync and then unpack it, then you get automatic recognizing some of the files.
Yes, it does. That's correct.
Flash cards.
Yes, and you can do that. You can do the shell script.
It would be nice if I could rearrange that and go through
the magic.
And
it'll be working properly now.
Well, why don't you create a tar file in memory? Then you can do them with the shell script, right? You could, what you could do, you could, your Perl script at least, you could create a file and slash temp, an unlinked file, you've got a file handle to it, then you could pipe tar to that, giving you a lump of memory, then you could pump that through rsync. You could do all this now. It's just, I'm not sure it's worth it as an option in the tool. Possibly.
Is it better than the dash dash fuzzy option?
Not really, because fuzzy, you'll end up with a massive block size. Say, for example, you want a smaller block size if possible. Okay, whereas if you tar up the whole thing, it's kind of a 40 megabyte file, and so typically you've got a large block size.
System flags. System flags.
You also, the cost of the algorithm, the numerical cost, the computational cost of it goes up as the file size increases more linearly, which means the total computational cost will go up by doing the tar file. It's not a bad method. I do actually do this sometimes when I'm transferring. I tar up files and ask them tar file of things. There are situations where it's actually quite useful, but I'm not sure there should be a standard option. Maybe it should instead be an example. How to do this, and this is useful in these situations.
What do you do when you just reshuffle your source?
The passing the tar file. You just don't use a byte for byte block size because you get funny artifacts. The header size of byte for byte is the server. It doesn't work as efficiently. It's exactly byte for byte block size.
Do you have a bit of time now?
Yeah.
You can't
change
yes, although there was some looking through from Finland. There was that. That
was around.
That'd be fine. I probably should ask them. I'm going to be around for the next couple of hours.
Yeah, I'll leave.
Oh, great, of course, yes. Okay, I'll just see if I can find those Finnish the Finnish group first. Okay. And then I'll just going to be. That's all.
Yeah,
I'll be ready. Any other questions you have?
Mark, somebody said this thing tonight was outside, outdoors, like grass. What's that? It's been raining. I have a
file and the actual backup. And the actual backup say it's maybe half an hour. And I was wondering, because I have these fanciful ideas of a nice, somehow tapping into a journal and file system, taking the journal, finding out what's been fitting.
What I'm saying is caching the file lists on the server using a TDB, a little database to cache the file lists. That means the reason it takes so long is it's a stat every file.
Yeah.
And statting every file means bringing in every inode, which means you have to bring in a full K block or 1K block or whatever for every single file, which is an awful lot of data. If your files are a few hundred bytes long, you bring in
people to over because the problem is it's a shared hosting server. There'll be lots of small HTML files, lots of CMD logs.
I haven't heard of being quite that bad if somebody made it. It is very expensive building that. If you just got more memory, then you'd end up with your directory cache. The Linux directory cache would improve things a lot if you had enough memory for it to store the. But it sounds like a twist file, never store it. The only other way is this option that I'm planning on bringing in, which is to cache that, or to go to this. This method, which doesn't actually build a file list first. The thing is, it'll still have to stab all the files.
Yeah.
The basic problem is you do have to stab all the files if you want to make sure that you do transfer all the data.
Right.
And stabbing all the files just takes a long time.
There was somebody who actually, I don't know, it obviously wasn't you, but somebody actually put a kernel patch where every single time a file was changed, it locked it somewhere, and then RSync uses that to crash it several
times. You know how there's OpenDIR and ReadDIR? ReadDIR reads one directory entry, okay? But GetDNS gets the next 50 directory entries. It'd be nice if there was a, you know, GetDStats or something, I don't know, that gets an array of stat structures for a whole directory as a single system call.
Yeah.
Now, if that can be done efficiently in the kernel by knowing about the file system layout, that would be fantastic. And that would be the way you'd really get it fast.
Right.
So talk to Steve before you can convince him to put in a get these stats option. Or put a, you know, stat directory or something. That would make the biggest difference. Or the alternative, run it on fat files. On fat would be really fast, because stacking on fat is very fast because the stat information is stored in the directory.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the one good thing about fat file system. So you run the whole thing on FAT32, you'll probably find it'll be really fast.
Perfect. Would it make any difference running several versus
you've still got
a much larger
process? Not really, unless you've got multiple things, it might even slow you down. The problem is that, you know, if you've got a million files and you're bringing in a 1K inode for each file, then you've got a gigabyte of data you've got to bring in. And I think it needs a gigabyte of data. Well, it only needs the first few bytes of each chunk, in fact. The thing is, you can't read, you know, you can only read at sector-sized units. So, it's just the design. The Unix file systems are not designed for this type of thing. It is really slow, whereas FAT is designed for this type of thing. So for this type of thing, it's actually very, very fast.
Yeah, but I'm sure that it's the size of the inode information. I don't know. It's a matter of supporting hard links. Any file system that supports hard links has a hard time also being fast for stack.
But if you're going to support small files, you need to support lots of files.
The most initialized whenever the device is open.
Entries in a directory go like
unless you intend to try. Unless you intend to try to run the.
Right. Okay.
Mode.
Directory
in the
tower.
Since anyway, how are you going to be able to do a million entries in the directory?
You got to be able
to do that. You want to plug it back in and have it work. So the trick is, the formula is, what you're supposed to do is in your suspend script, we'll just have it continue going, right? So the problem is, so the recipe is that what you're supposed to do is, in your suspend script, recommendation